And before I open the public hearing, I'd like to acknowledge where they're at.
Right in the front.
They're right in front, looking right over your head. We have Blaine Barklow and Chad Smith, who were students at the Southwestern Oregon Community College, and they were guests of mine on the floor of the Senate today, and have been with Representative Krieger this afternoon. I want to welcome you to our committee, and feel free to get up and leave anytime you have to, because sometimes this isn't the most exciting committee in the building. So we acknowledge that. So with that, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5501 and the fee bill for the Department of Agriculture, Senate Bill 5502. Ms. Coble, would you like to present the fee bill and any updates before we start the public hearing?
Do you want to do the fee bill first, or do you want to do the fee bill first?
Yes.
Then I'm going to have to bring staff up.
Sure.
Straight to us.
Mr. Chair, if I can.
Yes.
First, I'd like to announce to the committee, I believe we have the amplifier fixed, so, and these microphones are fairly sensitive, so you may want to make sure you're containing sidebar conversations. Also, just as an introduction to Senate Bill 5502, this is the fee ratification bill for the department. The legislature needs to ratify fees that were set during the interim, and that's what this bill will do.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask a procedural question? Is this our sole discretion? Does it have to go anyplace before it goes to the floor?
Senator Dukes, this would be the bill that comes directly to Ways and Means because it is strictly fee ratification of fees that are set in administrative rule, not in statute.
Okay. And for those presenting, I'll give you the same warning that we get ourselves. These mics are so sensitive, and these hearings are worldwide on the internet. And so be careful of the remarks you make as well. The whole world will know.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Proceed.
For the record, I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. I have Chuck Craig and Lisa Hansen with me to answer questions about the fee bill, and if we get into detailed questions, we have staff here who actually know something. As I understand it, Senate Bill 5502 are the list of fees that are either new fees to the agency or increases in fees for the agency. And I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, if you want us to go through each one in detail, if you want to kind of read down through it, see if you have questions. Obviously, we have a number of fees in the agency, and I'm not aware of any significant concern by individuals about these fees.
Why don't you briefly go on, and which document are you working off of?
I just have a copy of the fee bill in front of me. Senate Bill 5502.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, you have one question.
Senator Dukes.
What was your process in getting to these? And maybe you can talk about that as you go through the bill. Your process in getting to these new fees. I assume some public meetings and notifications and things. Just let us know.
For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Assistant Director with the Department of Agriculture. I'm going to talk about the first group of fees. The first one is the Good Handling, Good Agricultural Practices. There is an advisory committee set up for the Shipping Point Inspection Program. There was an advisory committee established to put this fee together, as well as working through the full rulemaking process. So there were public hearings held and public input throughout the process of establishing the fee. And that would be true of the fees for the fertilizer program, as well as the fee for the vapor meters, which is a new fee that the industry asked us to set a program for.
Okay. I didn't even ask what vapor meters, kind of vapors they measure, Mr. Chair. I'm happy going on.
Okay, any other questions? Senator Krieger, are you thinking of questions or reading?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if you'd like me to address Section 2, I do that for the record. Chuck Craig with Department of Agriculture. The fees in Section 2 are increases in existing fees. There are two of them that relate to the brands program, and then there's a long list of them that relate to the nursery Christmas tree program, essentially. And these are fees that have been increased with the consent of the industry that's paying them. In the nursery Christmas tree industry, we have advisory committees that we work with closely, and on these brand fees, the livestock auction market people. And they've been increased for cost recovery purposes. The first two, brand inspection fee for horses that where the inspection takes place at a public auction market has been increased to the same amount that it is for an inspection that takes place at an individual's place of business. It was somewhat lower at auction markets because there was at one time a higher volume and a more efficient operation there. That's not really true anymore. So that just raises that fee to be more in line with what it costs. The fee for the book of transportation certificates, which are required to be filled out if you're transporting cattle or horses on the highway, the book costs $1.32 to print, and it costs some amount of postage to send it to people. We were charging a dollar for it before, and so it's just a cost recovery. And then for the nursery related fees, we've been losing money in this program, and the number of certifications, inspections, and so forth has increased steadily over the years because of the growth in this industry. And so what this increase in fees does is basically will bring us up to where the fund here will actually cover the cost, and our balance in the account won't continue to decline. We have been carrying the program on a declining cash balance for some time, and there's very strong approval for this set of fee increases from the industries that are affected. And if there are specific questions about this, Dan Hilburn from our plant division is very familiar with all of it, and I'm sure he'd be happy to respond.
Chuck, we talked a little bit about this, I think, yesterday. My guess is that not all of these fees are associated with mandatory requirements for license. And so, could, maybe not today, but could you send us information which breaks that out?
Which are more like fee for service instead of
what was the one we were talking about yesterday? That, or maybe it wasn't this committee. And some of the other committees, I guess it is, we've talked about some certificates, as an example, are not required by law, but it does help people sell their products. And so I think that would make a difference to us. And any written justification or documents you have showing support, my guess is that not everyone impacted by these fee increases will be here today to testify. Many of them well, I'm sure, but if you have any room from different associations or anything that would indicate for the record that there's support, would be helpful too.
We'll be glad to do that, Mr. Chair, and Dan Hilburn just informed me that most of these fees are required by the market somewhere, not by our law specifically by statute, but by the entity that's purchasing on the other end. So we'll give you a breakdown and any documentation on support.
Any other Any other questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you. Did you have anything you wanted to add from your information yesterday?
No, Mr. Chairman. We had been talking about getting you the information on the ending balances in our accounts. Paul connected with us this morning and has requested some additional information, so we prepared that information for him, and we'll go back now to working on the ending balance numbers and get that to Paul.
Good. Mr. Gregor.
Mr. Chair, normally fees are designed to raise a given number of dollars. What is the total that you're trying to raise through the fees?
In the nursery Christmas tree area, which is the one I can speak to in the brands area, the nursery Christmas tree area is roughly $700,000 biennium. And for the brands, $12,000 or $14,000. I'm not sure what's right in that brand.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
We're going to go to public hearings, but before we open to the public, Representative Krupp, would you like to come up and testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the courtesy. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp from House District 17, and I do appreciate the courtesy. I'm chairing my own meeting right now, but I felt it important that I spend a few minutes just to come and share with you my thoughts in regards to what I think is the importance of Oregon Department of Agriculture's marketing program and how it makes a difference to farmers who are trying to sell their value-added products across the world. I had the great pleasure of actually going on a trade mission with members of the Department of Agriculture and several growers to Japan. And the purpose of this was for us to have interaction, continuing interaction with grocery store people, Japanese food industry groups, Japanese Ministry of Agriculture and Forestry, regards to value-added products that these farmers that we traveled there with were producing and selling in some of the more upscale grocery stores in Japan. Fascinating trip. Absolutely fascinating. And I can tell you that in my entire time there, and we were there a little over a week, that as we met with people constantly, it was evident to me that the groundwork that the Oregon Department of Agriculture had laid over the years in food marketing to help farmers market their products was very evident in that the individuals we met with were very receptive to the opportunities that we as growers would have, and I call myself a grower because I am a fifth-generation farmer, to market our products there and how important those relationships are. And I think ODA has done a great job and of really laying that groundwork and helping us and assisting us. The issues, some of I'm sure which you've talked about, have not been in your meetings, but you will continue to hear about identity preservation protocols. These are huge, huge issues to the Japanese right now because they have, and I use this term a lot, what I came away with from Japan was that my impression is they are freaked out over food safety issues. I think there's no other way to say it. They have had a mad cow scare of unprecedented proportions. They're spending $2 billion U.S. on a identity program that tracks that calf from its very inception all the way through the meat process to where it's sold. As a Japanese consumer, you can go into their supermarket and see a 10-digit barcode that you can look up so that you're sure that that beef is everything they say it is. And it went on and on and on in terms of issues regarding food safety. And it became very, very apparent to me that ODA has been involved in these discussions and that their knowledge and their experience and their ability to communicate with the Japanese food industry over there and the Japanese government about these issues is a big help to Oregon growers who want to sell their products there in light of new restrictions and new government programs that are coming into effect. And so basically what I want to tell you is that I think their marketing program is a very, very big help to Oregon growers to move our products to other markets, including the one I have the experience with is the Japanese. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would just conclude my testimony.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments to Representative Krupp?
Thank you.
Appreciate your input from the Natural Resource Committee. What I'm going to do now is I have one person that wants to present a testimony from more than 100 miles away, and I've got a note here that we have Carla Chavez, who needs to get back to the farm. So, Nick Furman, could you come up, and Carla, could you come up, please? And the procedure is that we need to have you identify your, give your name before you start your testimony.
Well, thank you. I think that my name is Carla Chambers, and my husband and I own Stallbush Island Farms. We're a farming and food processing company in Corvallis, Oregon. My family's been farming in Oregon 117 years. And I think what Representative Kropp told you was very, very accurate. I've got some Japanese customers coming in tonight, and I'll spend all day tomorrow with them. And I think his term on the Japanese food market is correct. I think the Japanese consumer is very paranoid about their food supply today. In addition to the mad cow disease, the reason this company is coming tonight, and I'll spend all day with them tomorrow, is we will be growing an enormous amount of product that was being grown in China. The chemical companies in China are illegally adding DDT to the chemicals, not labeling it. The Japanese government's very astute in picking these chemicals up. They're rejecting the products from China, and the Japanese consumer has said, you know, we've had enough, and we're not buying this. So we will plant an enormous amount. Already 35% of our business, 35% of our exports go into the Asian, specifically Japanese market. We will be talking at length. This is the fifth largest food company in the world that will be at our farm all day tomorrow. We will spend an enormous amount of time tomorrow not only talking about what they need us to plant, but the GMO issue, genetically modified. How are we going to assure them that our sweet corn is GM-free? Food safety issues, pesticide residue testing, what laboratories will we use? Enormous amount of detail and time will go into addressing the food safety concerns. What the representative said about the digit, the digital code on the back of the vegetables is absolutely right. They've just done a movie on our farm that when that Japanese consumer puts that code in on the back of those vegetables, our farm will come up in Oregon, and that consumer can see, you know, how that product was grown, where it was grown, what was used. They will see the husband and wife, you know, farm team that made those vegetables possible. So how does the department play a role in this? We have worked extensively with Jim Cramer and Dalton Hobbs. You've got third-party credibility with the department in these markets where the government is just everything for that credibility. They can open up these markets. They can help us create new markets. They can help us with the testing procedures. Dalton this afternoon is helping me on pesticide understanding some pesticide regulation issues in Japan, really preparing for this meeting tomorrow. I had the opportunity to be part of the governor's transition team. And it was one of the reasons that Katie was put into as director of the Department of Agriculture, is we really recognized the need for additional marketing and economic development in the Department of Agriculture. These markets are changing at an enormously rapid pace. What the customers and consumers are expecting is changing dramatically. The testing, the pesticide residue issues, is just changing at a very fast pace. This department will play a key role in our ability to change and really supply those markets in the future. But we need that help and that emphasis on marketing and economic development. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming, Carla. Until I heard your testimony, I don't think I had made the linkage quite so clearly between the question of marketing our product as being a certain kind of product. And the question I want to ask you is, last session we had a lengthy debate about a pesticide reporting process.
And I know that some folks in the farm community were very opposed to that. You have been a leader in that community. And given the testimony that you have just offered about the insistence, particularly in the Japanese market, of a pesticide-free product, could you comment a little bit on your experience as a farmer and your thoughts about us finishing the pesticide reporting program and rolling it out for growers in Oregon to use?
Yeah. I think my husband and I have really taken a leadership position on not only sustainable agriculture, but really minimizing the use of pesticides and chemicals in our operation. We have really moved enormously at an enormous pace toward technology and electronic innovation as a replacement to chemicals and pesticides in our daily operation. I have not been afraid of pesticide use reporting. I've supported it. I felt it would give us better information and probably really be helpful to the ag community over the long run. I think what we will find is what many states have found is agriculture tends to be very responsible in the use of some of these inputs. We're lowering, and I think what we will find too is that really many of the issues are with the city road spraying programs, many of the city use, and many of the retail and home use problems and chemical issues.
Thank you.
So I think we should move forward.
Let me ask you a related question. Do you see a danger in some of that usage adjacent to your cropland?
And will that impact your how you'll certify your product?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
You mentioned the road departments.
Yeah.
And you're concerned about how they apply their pesticides. Is that a concern of yours with your certified crops?
Yeah, that is a concern. I've got an issue right now with aerial spraying. It is a concern because these markets are really changing. Things are being tested. Our level of detect is so great. And what consumers in other countries are demanding has really changed. The roadside spraying is a big issue. I've traveled extensively in New Zealand. They don't spray their roads. They have grass roadways. And they mow. They work with the farmers, and those roadsides are mowed. It's absolutely beautiful. You know, here we are in the grass seed capital of the world. That's a big issue. Offside road spraying, you know, is a big issue.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming. Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Nick Furman. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission and the Administrator for the Oregon Albacore Commission, two industry-funded commodity commissions that operate under the umbrella of the Oregon Department of Agriculture and that collectively represent 813 commercial fishing permit holders along the Oregon coast. I drove the 3 hours up here today from the South Coast because I feel strongly about the role of the Department of Agriculture, its mission, its people, and most importantly, its potential. Over the past 12 years, I've had the opportunity to work alongside many of the agency's staff on a variety of projects designed to assist the fishing industry, fishing and seafood industries, and as a result, I feel I'm abundantly qualified to comment on the performance and value. But today, I'd like to tell you about just a few of the ways that ODA has helped my industry. The Dungeness crab harvest on the Oregon coast doesn't begin until the Food Safety Division, working in concert with the industry, conducts tests for domoic acid to ensure that our crop is toxin-free and can be sent into the marketplace with the high levels of product safety assurance consumers demand and deserve. Oregon seafood processors depend on this program and would be reluctant to purchase, freeze, inventory the millions of dollars worth of crab annually without the confidence this valuable service provides. Most, if not all, of the significant export opportunities for Oregon seafood have developed as a result of the ongoing efforts of the Ag Development Marketing Division located in Portland. A trade lead generated at an overseas trade show. A potential customer introduced to Dungeness crab through an in-country technical seminar. An on-site plant inspection scheduled during an incoming trade mission. A meeting set up with the foreign ATO in support of a targeted promotion. These examples and many more activities like them have made it possible for Oregon seafood companies to establish a presence in markets as diverse as China, Korea, Japan, and Europe. The Ag Development and Marketing Division also provides leadership and support in the domestic marketplace by creating market opportunities for seafood companies at major U.S. food service and grocery industry trade shows around the country. They've worked with the Seafood Commodity Commissions on targeted promotions and have provided significant assistance to the industry's trade show vehicle known as Seafood Oregon. In addition to marketing, the seafood industry relies on ADMD for technical assistance, like helping with shipping and transportation logistics, information about constantly changing tariffs and regulations, and help with new product development and introduction. It's quite simple. If you need an answer, you call ODA. Last year, when the newly formed Albacore Commission came to ODA after losing $30,000 in assessment income due to an unscrupulous fish buyer who withheld money from the fishermen but neglected to forward it to the commission as required by law, staff from the director's office coordinated a meeting with ODF&W officials and coastal legislatures, which resulted in legislation, which is House Bill 2033, that will, if passed, ensure that all fees, assessment, and assessments are paid before buyer's licenses are reissued. Thanks to Representative Albert Brown, ODF&W, and ODA, the fishermen's hard-earned money will go towards efforts designed to benefit them and not into the pockets of a few crooks on the coast. When the shrimp fishermen and processors were in an impasse over price negotiations a few years back, costing the industry and coastal communities millions in lost revenue and opportunity, ODA stepped in and brought the two parties together for meaningful face-to-face talks that brought an end to the tie-up and got the industry back to work. Staff from the director's office are currently working with the Crab Commission on legislation that would create a supervised negotiation process similar to the one spelled out in HB 3811 on behalf of the perennial ryegrass industry, and that would allow fishermen and processors to get together and establish a fair opening price with protection from state and federal antitrust regulations. We think this bill could help eliminate the acrimony that resulted in a three-week delay to the start of this crab season's harvest and deprived consumers of fresh Oregon Dungeness during much of the holiday period. And I just want to publicly right now thank Senators Messerly and his staff for working diligently to get that in the hopper for us. We appreciate that. Past directors of the department have provided us with an opportunity to speak before the Board of Agriculture in order to make a wheat farmer in Pendleton get a better understanding of the issues and challenges facing the commercial crabber in Newport. They've helped us bridge the gap between ocean-based harvesters on the coast and the dirt-based farmers that make up the vast majority of Oregon's agriculture in the Willamette Valley and beyond. ODA has made sure that the seafood industry has a place at the table. I'd like to close with these few comments and observations. It's no secret the commercial fishing industry faces some difficult fishing industry and seafood industry face some difficult challenges as we confront the realities of a new era of fisheries management. Quite frankly, we need all the help we can get. In my opinion, ODA plays and will play an important role in that transition process. We are confident that the leadership of the department will create exciting opportunities for all facets of Oregon agriculture. We look forward to working with Katie Cobra and her staff to help find new and creative ways to market and promote Oregon's abundant seafood resource. We benefit from and support their programs and encourage legislators to fund the agency at a level where they can continue to provide the services we in the fishing and seafood industries have grown to depend on.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your very thoughtful testimony. It seems by your validation of their efforts that this marketing program is very successful, and I'd invite either one of you to answer this question. There has been some confusion between marketing of Oregon products that's done in the Department of Economic Development and the marketing program that's done by the Department of Agriculture. I think I can extrapolate from your testimony the fact that agriculture, marketing agriculture, that there's a level of expertise there that might not exist someplace else. Have you had any experience, either one of you, with Oregon Economic and Community Development marketing ag products and how successful or not successful that was?
If I could just make a brief comment, the seafood industry has benefited from past programs and marketing efforts of economic development. Regional strategies money was used for a number of different projects along the coast that benefited the seafood industry. But I think when it comes to direct marketing of our commodities, we've looked to the leadership and the expertise at ODA almost exclusively. in that process?
I think that Oregon needs about all the help it can get in marketing and economic development, and agriculture should be involved at both levels. I think the way I would look at the difference, though, is there's a lot of technical and scientific support that goes along with opening up a lot of these export markets. And with those markets changing so radically, that's why you need that higher level of specialization and knowledge within the department.
Thank you.
I might add that there is discussion, at least at the Ways and Means level, of looking at both those programs and making sure that they're coordinating well and supporting each other. And I think that that is important, that we are continually watching for that and making sure that they are supportive of each other.
Makes a lot of sense to me. And when you get into Brand Oregon or promotional activities that involve the entire state of Oregon, you certainly want agriculture or forest products, involved in those efforts as well, high tech. So you want agriculture involved in those.
Coupled with that, we all know that we've worked on these kind of programs or taken trade missions to foreign countries, that the contacts you have are absolutely the most important thing. And so I think that's what needs to be shared as well.
Absolutely. And our Japanese markets, that contact with Oregon or the government representative is everything.
Okay. Representative Krueger.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Furman, didn't they just pass the buyback bill back east?
Yes.
Look at that, and that means those people who remain in the fishery are going to have to diversify and find new markets. And I think that's, for your industry, that is the future, because we can't. The entire ground stock fishery that you're using now, the Sebastius complex, we only know a little about those. We're only fishing three or four of them real hard. Yet there's all these other fish out there that have potential, and we really haven't marketed those fish.
I think if ODA has a strong point as far as seafood marketing is concerned, is trying to identify markets for underutilized species on the coast. They've done a tremendous job. They're working with seafood processors and fishermen on the south coast right now in a partnership with a Korean company, and they've helped to create that relationship. And I think it's been quite successful on behalf of our industry.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you both very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call Al Elkins and John McCauley. Could you both come up, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Al Elkins. I'm representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I wanted to talk today just briefly about the predator control program and the need to restore funding to that program. The Oregon Hunters Association over the last year has contributed over $20,000 to help counties deal with predator control. We've worked, sent money to Wallowa County, Harney County, East Klamath Falls County, Malheur County, Crook and Lake Counties, and Baker County. And in all these situations, the cattlemen have helped us by matching the funds that we have sent. We think this is an extremely important program, not only to the cattlemen, but to also helping to keep the management of wildlife and wildlife numbers up in those areas. As a member of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and Oregon Department of Agriculture Damage Control Council, we heard a lot of testimony that parallels the Board of Commissioners from Coos County and their letter that basically are saying we have more bears and lions than ever before and more coyotes. That's what we heard statewide as we toured the state. So I think this is an extremely important program, and would recommend that funding be restored to that. And in closing, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would the board of the Oregon Hunters Association would just like to commend the Department of Agriculture, Roger Huffman, and his staff for the work that they did on the Rodeo Ranch situation where we had the case of the cervid with the TB. They put in hundreds of thousands of hours to meet the area potential devastating problem, not only with wildlife, but also with cattle in that area. And we commend the work that they did and the partnership they had with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Al. Any questions, comments? Mr. Elkins? John?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley. I'm going to wear several hats, if I might, and get it all done here at once today. First, I want to put on my hat as the administrator of the Oregon Clover Commission, one of the 28 commodity commissions in the state, to say some good words about the help that that industry has received from the Oregon Department of Agriculture. That industry faced a, I guess you could call it a life-threatening weed in the fall of 1999, when a federally listed noxious weed was found in a clover seed field not too far from Charbonneau. As a result of that, the federal government slapped a quarantine on the sale of clover seed in the state of Oregon, and we had to work with the Oregon Department of Agriculture and with USDA to make sure that it didn't cripple our industry. We were successfully able to do that. The Department of Agriculture has been very supportive of our efforts to work under that quarantine so that we are able to continue to sell clover seed in the United States. Oregon is the largest producer of clover seed in the United States, primarily Washington and Yamhill counties, although it is grown throughout western Oregon and in Malheur County in eastern Oregon. But the results of the work of Jim Kramer and Dan Hilburn and Tim Butler in the department have led us to the point where we're able to work very well under that quarantine. Growers are surviving, even though the price of clover seed is down. Nonetheless, because of the efforts of the department, we are still in business, and I think it's important that the committee know that those types of things happen on behalf of farmers in this state. I'm going to put on my county fair hat now, since I think you've all been waiting for the, well, maybe you haven't, I don't know. I just want to, first of all, start by expressing appreciation to all the members of this subcommittee, because you have all been, in your legislative careers, very supportive of fairs in this state, and I just want you to know that we really appreciate that. We also appreciate the difficulties that you're facing during this legislative session. I think it's important to note that the history of the relationship between county fairs and the Oregon legislature is a long one. It really began at statehood, but formally has been going on for 70 years now. So this is not a new program, as it were. I've attached to my testimony information about the fairs in the state of Oregon, the contributions that they make to their communities, but I think you all know that. My purpose here today is twofold, to let you know that based on the legislation that was approved last session, a county fair commission has been reconstituted. I have provided some testimony from the county fair commission listing the members of that commission. They were all eventually appointed by the end of July last year, have held several meetings so far, and are in the process of preparing to review reports that will be submitted to county fairs, or submitted to them from county fairs, based on reporting forms developed by this commission. The commission held a workshop at the recent Oregon Fairs Association convention on what they expect the fairs to be able to provide, and I think that the legislation will have its intended effect of really improving the operation of fairs throughout the state, and we appreciate especially Representative Johnson's involvement in making that happen. The second purpose for my being here today is to really let you know that we would like to work with the Department of Agriculture and with this committee, looking at the level of funding for county fairs and seeing if there are ways that we can work with you to how should I say this, share that funding with others without destroying the fairs in the state. We believe that there are some things that we can do. There are some funds that that we can work to provide to the hopefully the Department of Agriculture to help with other programs while at the same time maintaining support for county fairs in the state. And I have received authorization from the leadership of our organization to make that offer and see how we can work with you to I guess, reduce the amount of funding going to county fairs in hopes that it can help some other parts of the department's budget.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And speaking for the committee, as you probably know, or maybe you don't know, we're canceling all of our subcommittee meetings next week so that we can solely deal with the 0103 budget and get that out of the way, and then move forward into a 305. So the type of cooperation that we're hearing from both the organizations is very much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair, just maybe a comment from Mr. Elkins' testimony. There's a direct relationship, I think, between predators and wildlife numbers of elk, deer, upland game birds. And if you lose opportunity to have seasons and tag numbers because of lack of numbers, then you reduce the Department of Fish and Wildlife's tag and license sales, which impacts that agency also. So there is kind of a connect there, and we see that going on with the elk numbers in East Norridge from cougar predation. So we need to make sure we do have a predator program that's meeting the needs of both the hunters and the farmer and rancher community.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator Duke.
Just a comment. John, that's a very generous offer, and I didn't see any details here. I assume staff has been provided with those. You guys fought hard for this money.
I know we did, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes. We don't have any details yet. That's why I would like to sit down with the department and staff and whomever to see if we can arrive at some numbers that are going to work.
Might want to do that quickly. Before we get in and just take it.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you both very much. Appreciate it. Next, I'd like to call Richard Kosas on and John McDonald. I hope you're not going to read all that, Richard.
Predator control, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Richard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard Kosasan with the Oregon Sheep Growers Association. There's a packet of information that I would like to, I think according to the chair, quickly run through. But it deals with the Wildlife Services Predator Control Program through the state, specifically through the State Department of Agriculture and the Department of Fish and Wildlife. The first page would indicate your funding levels from 89-91 biennium to 2001-2003 biennium. Basically, you can see the state funding throughout the years is relatively flat. We lost some state support in the early 90s, and were able to capture that back in recent years. But during the 2001-2003 biennium, the state dollars flowing through the Department of Ag were significantly reduced. Representative Krieger, more than aware, but during the 2001 legislative session, $75,000 was earmarked for bear damage research, and that was one of the first programs to be cut during the special sessions because it was a new program. During the course of the last year, the core program of the Department of Ag's funding for predator control was reduced by approximately $120,000, and that was for the second year of the biennium. That represented a little over 50% of the dollars flowing through the Department of Ag. Basically, I think that gives you a description of the funding. The thing that I would point out is that the program is truly a cooperatively funded program. The program receives a substantial portion of federal funding, state funding through ODA, ODFNW, counties, currently there are 24 participating counties, and individual cooperators throughout the state. You'll see the individuals noted down there in 2001, 2003 at 121,800. Now, these individuals are participating and assisting to make the program as viable as it can throughout the state. But if you break it down, the state portion through ODA and ODF&W, people have suggested that it's a minuscule amount and rather insignificant. I think to the contrary, that represents about 15% of the total funding requirements that come from the state. And in light of the cooperatively funded nature of the program, that's very, very essential. It's not just a livestock program. If you look at the program overall, Wildlife Services deals with airports, airport safety, public protection. In the last 2 years, if you look at 2001, I think Wildlife Services responded to over 100 inquiries regarding public safety as a result of cougars. 2002, the number went up to about 121. You look at the timber resources, bear and beaver damage is astronomical. And finally, it does indeed impact livestock predation. But overall, the program in recent years deals with 2,000 plus ag producers. These are small family farms. I, for one, would be an individual that would argue that this is truly economic development at its finest. If we lose that assistance, I think that a lot of these small farms are in danger. So, with that, now I can get to the meat of the program here. The next page is very quick. It gives you an identification of the funding and the programs. But there is, for your information, a livestock loss survey, or the results of that survey from 1999. And just kind of for perspective, in 99, I'm looking at the wrong one. In Oregon, for example, sheep producers were estimated to lose approximately...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Richard, where are you in what paper that you gave us?
Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, if you would go to the third page, and that is the National Ag Statistics Service, sheep and goats, predator loss.
I got it.
And if you would like to turn to page... 5 and 6, you'll see just in terms of sheep producers throughout the state, they lost to predators 3,300 sheep, 7,500 lambs. The value was $264,000 and $300,000 respectively for sheep and lamb losses. And coupled with that, there is the report conducted by the Oregon Ag Statistics Service. It's somewhat out of date, but I think it was one of the more comprehensive reviews done in the state of Oregon.
And where are you looking there, Richard?
That's, Mr. Chair, that's past the first publication, past the National Ag Statistics Service sheep and goat predator loss information. And that is noted as the 97 Oregon Wildlife Damage Survey. But if you were to take a look at that in terms of livestock losses, a sample of about 6,000 producers, livestock losses total 1.5 million plus. Coupled with that, in terms of that report, I think one thing that it deserves highlighting is the damage prevention costs of $6 million. So producers throughout the state are undertaking significant efforts to avoid losses. Those numbers are outside the Wildlife Services funding. Beyond that, there is a National Ag Statistics Service cattle predator loss information. That is followed just very quickly, Mr. Chair, on page 7 of that report, you'll see in terms of predator, the loss in terms of the cattle industry in Oregon 2000 year, you lost approximately $200,000 worth of cattle and approximately $1.1 million in terms of calves. Again, fairly significant. That is followed by a National Ag Statistics Service report on tree fruit production. Very quickly, the information there is rather interesting, but it is not. It's generic in nature. It does not specifically identify production in Oregon, but it gives you a flavor for the magnitude of the problem. That is followed by a general piece of information, again, from Department of Ag in terms of overall wildlife damage. That's followed by a piece of information, a little bit outdated, but it was November 12, 1998, an article from the Eastern Oregonian indicating that on the final page of that, basically it's a clear indication that the livestock predator control program is vital to the ag industry. And a final piece is a letter or a copy of a piece of correspondence from the Board of Commissioners in Coos County identifying the cooperative funding nature of the program and the significance of the program. And I think that's all I have.
Not bad. Richard, on your first page, the individual contribution, since 97, 99, that's been dropping. What's going on there?
Mr. Chair, the individual... Okay, I see what you're talking about. That I don't know. I can't address that specifically. It could be the type of complaints and the exact type of situations that individual producers are facing in the various counties.
And I'm looking at the dollar figure. I assume the markets... Down markets would play a factor in that, too.
In terms of the sheep industry within the state of Oregon, Mr. Chair, rule of thumb, within the last 3 years, we have lost slightly over a third of our production. That directly reflects the market conditions for both lamb, the meat, and the wool.
And would indicate the number of sheep ranchers that just went out of business?
Mr. Chair, that's fairly accurate. We have lost, in the state of Oregon, I think it would be safe to say that we've lost about a third of our producers.
Richard, we've asked, we've been reviewing the Department of Ag budget now for this our fifth day, started a week ago. And we've had conversations with the department about the impact if this program was not funded from the state of Oregon. Could you speak to that a little bit? I mean, the program's not going to totally go away, I wouldn't think, but in some areas it probably would. And it would impact not only agriculture, forestry, road departments, cities, a lot of local governments as well. From your perspective, could you give us some insight on that?
Mr. Chair, as I previously indicated, you have 24 counties participating in the cooperative funding program right now. And as we have seen over the years, if you lose the funding through the state of Oregon, both through Department of Ag as well as ODF&W, it just exacerbates the problems experienced by the county governors or county governments that participate in the program. If you go back to your first page, if you look in the 93-95 biennium, after we lost significant amounts of dollars through the state, the number of participating counties decreased. I would say that it's kind of like a three-legged stool. If you take out one leg, you're not going to have a lot of stability there.
And if you note from your figures, it's interesting that the federal government doubles what all the other sources provide for this, too. Any other comments or questions? Representative Krieger?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think you're right on. You talk about the value of the product coming off the land. And in forestry, the last 2 or 3 years, that market has dropped off, so a lot of the small woodland owners aren't contributing or as much. In Curry County, we give a dollar an acre. I got 300 acres every year. I pay $300, and you have to do that whether you're harvesting or not. So it makes a difference.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you, Richard. Before I go on, and can you hear us in the back? We went, as I said, for 4 days and found out last night that the microphone wasn't, or the speaker wasn't working, and the people in the back couldn't hear us talking up here. So
nobody complained, though.
No, they didn't complain. There's a message there someplace. Oh, good.
Didn't wake them up, anyway.
Sir, would you like to proceed, please?
Yes, my name is John McDonald. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. I am a district director as well in Washington County. Yes, that is easy there. A member of the Watershed Council. And I also happen to be a hazelnut grower. So if any of you would like to add squirrels and blue jays to any of these predator lists, I would be extremely happy. We can talk about economic loss as they feed their families with the nuts we grow. I apologize that I have not been aware of the hearing.
Senator Dukes.
How do the blue jays open the nuts?
They drop them. They're very smart. They fly over highways and drop them.
On the highways. Okay, I was thinking under dirt wasn't going to do it for them. No. The trucks get them and they go out against the guys. Okay, thank
you. They can also play the little jackhammer and use the little beak and try to get to them too.
Thank you. I was there with the squirrels. I wasn't there with the blue jays. Gotcha. Okay.
Glad we've got that on the record, though. Proceed.
But thank you for asking. I've never been asked that before. Okay. I apologize that I have not had a chance to participate in the hearings of the previous 5 days about the budget. Unfortunately, I was in Florida attending a National Association meeting and last 3 days in Baker County making some trips back. So I came in last night and found out that maybe there are some issues regarding the funding that goes to the conservation districts, and I wish to address a couple of those things. One of the items I understand has been addressed is the need for the administrative money that goes to each district. That is a very important source of funds for us because it does one particular thing that no other source of funds does, and that is it allows us to have the funding to do the statutory requirements that are in our law, ORS 568. There are five major things that we are required to do, a full audit, for example, or at least a financial letter, depending on the income that we have in each district, an annual meeting, annual reports, long-range plans, annual plans, and stuff like that. And just the actual staff time it takes to prepare those things, maybe having to rent rooms for annual meetings and stuff like that, publications, mailing costs, you know, the typical things you would expect. That $8,000 actually goes as the administrative money to pay for those required items. These are functions that every district has to do, you know, whether you have a $5,000 budget or you have a $1 million budget. So the state has actually put in the money over these long years to allow each district to be able to maintain those required functions so that we can stay legal, as we say. The second source of funds that has come to the districts through the Department of Agriculture has been the local management agency funds, which were either in the process of planning the local agricultural water quality plan or possibly the implementation of it. Of course, as you all well could imagine, the amount of money that it takes to implement a plan out there and so forth is considerably more than what we would ever receive. We're projecting maybe only $5,000 to $10,000 per district to or per county to do those processes this year. Therefore, obviously, we're looking for other sources of funds to do that. The third source of funds, which is very, very important because it gets right at the heart of the service that we provide, which is the technical assistance to landowners. And that about $34,000 per county is going to you know, to fund the operation. For counties that have two districts, there are six of those. Of course, they have to split that 34-4, so they're getting 17. And Baker County with four districts, of course, splits it four ways.
So there's at least an equity by county. It's also, I think, important to understand about the funding of districts that, yeah, I'm getting caught in mouth here, that it's a hard kind of balancing act, because we don't have any monies coming to the districts that are primarily for staffing. We don't have a personnel budget that says, you know, you can maintain three people or two people on staff and that they could pick up whatever work seems to come their way. All of our funds, including the funds that come from the Department of Agriculture, have specific services and products tied to them. So we occasionally get positions, for example, in Washington County, we have three people on staff. The person who is our main resource planner and our technical assistant is actually funded out of nine different projects. So we've had to raise money in nine different grants and so forth, or contracts or something, to be able to actually build a full position so we could employ that individual. Every single individual on our staff is funded by more than one. In fact, our person who's the administrative assistant, who's doing a lot of bookkeeping, recording, and stuff like that, is paid out of a piece of 11 different projects. So it's kind of a delicate balance, and if we start nibbling away, at, you know, if we take out this one, we take out that one, and so forth, I hate to use these terms because it's descriptive, but it's, I don't want to leave the wrong impression. It's almost like a house of cards. Start pulling out one card, pretty soon, you know, the ability to sustain that individual or that amount of work is going to have an impact. And as we, if we start to lose one, then we're going to, of course, jeopardize our ability to do the other projects that we've also assigned the people to. And so it gets kind of complex and kind of confusing at times, but it's a delicate balance of what we have to do, because we essentially are charged to go out and raise our own funds, other than the funds that come through the Department of Agriculture. We've been very, very fortunate in the support we receive from, like, the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and now we're getting more and more into other areas, such as BLM and BOR, and BPA has been, you know, heavily involved in the ones along the Columbia Basin and so forth. But I'm also here to say so a couple other things that I think are very important, and that is the relationship between OACD, my organization, the districts in general, and the Department of Agriculture has never been better. And I can frankly say 5 years ago I would have said, well, we're doing okay. Now I can say we're doing well. The leadership is much more involved. You probably heard from our resident hero a few years ago, John Mallott, who was kind of the department's focal point for dealing with districts. That's actually broadened. We're now dealing with more and more people on staff. The relationships, the technical assistance, the help that we're getting from their experts to our people out in the field in hydrology and public relations and so forth has been invaluable. So we're proud of that. We also think in the districts we've made enormous progress in the last couple of years, because we've really decided that what we need to do is be a whole lot more responsive to community needs and responsible and accountable. We're doing an awful lot of work to set up structures whereby, you know, people aren't just given money, but there's defined work plans, there's defined long-range plans. We've identified exactly how to target these kinds of things. In fact, so well that those of you familiar with the relationship between districts and the Natural Resources Conservation Service, it is now the plan as to how we go into the local decision-making, that how we target the federal funds is determined by what the districts come in with as far as the resource descriptions and the prioritization and the recommendation of practices. And they're taking that and then putting it into things like cost share levels and incentive rates and so forth. So the work of the districts is much more central to bringing in the federal money. And I'm frankly afraid, particularly with the impetus coming from the new farm bill, that if we cut back the technical assistance and the level of effort, we're going to leave a lot of money on the table. And it's already hard to go back to the Ohios and the Nebraskas and stuff like that and say, Oregon isn't getting its fair share. And then for them to come back and say, well, so what? You don't even spend what we do give you. You know, because you can't get the technical work done. And it's very important to realize that we can't give a dollar to a landowner out there to do something required under some statute or maybe the Clean Water Act or maybe just good conservation and soil preservation, you know, unless a plan is done. And plans aren't done by farmers. I can't do the one that I use on my property. I don't have the technical skills. I don't know how to do surveying.
I've got six more people need to testify in less than 50 minutes. So if you could kind of pull it together, or if you'd like to submit written material, that would be very acceptable, too.
Well, I would just like to say that the relationship that of districts to making things happen, the implementation of SB 1010, to the stuff about Clean Water Act and Endangered Species Act and so forth is very, very important. And that we certainly urge that the full funding amount that you can find somewhere in with our limited resources would be extremely appreciated. Thank you.
I do have a couple of questions for you, too. We've had some discussion here in the last few days about some of the counties, that have more than one district, and I think you mentioned one of them has four.
Baker County has four, yes.
And you have six that have two districts. Is there discussion about how to be more efficient and maybe combine some of these counties? I realize that some of it just the geography, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but...
I spoke at the annual meeting of Baker County a couple of nights ago, and I actually asked them, why do you have four here? And you could have almost split the room right down the middle of four of them were saying, absolutely, we want to keep our identity. We've got a lot invested. We have a lot of pride. We have a lot of special characteristics about our watershed that's different from the other one. And the other half of the room would have said, fine, you know, we could consolidate. It's an emotional issue there.
Maybe a better question is, does the county get a block grant and then they divide it four ways?
Yes.
So they are paying a price then for their...
They've actually formed an association to where they almost come together as four different district boards operating through a central staff.
Okay. Second question, how many counties do not financially support their districts?
In the survey that we did in 2000, which is the last information that I have, 10 counties were providing, 10 districts were receiving no money from the counties. Of course, there was the exception of the ones with the permanent tax rates, you know, where Marion and now Polk and Yamhill are receiving that. There were another 22 that had between $0 and $10,000 from the county, and then the balance of those were receiving between 10 and 40.
And I'm not sure we have time here at this hearing, but I would like to have an opportunity to discuss with you the relationship between soil and water districts and the watershed associations. My understanding is that some counties do a very good job of that, and some counties it just isn't working that well at all. And so if you could maybe...
Senator Messerly and members of the committee, I would be thrilled. Absolutely thrilled to sit down and discuss the relationship of districts and counties and areas where it's working and why, areas where it's not working and why it's not, and start looking for some answers to what, unfortunately, in my perception, is an increasingly difficult situation.
Thank you. Any comments or questions?
Yes, Senator Deuce.
I know that periodically there's a push to try to get soil and water districts on their own tax base, and I see you're up to three now.
Yes.
I take it that's not being very successful. How many, in the last few years, how many districts have tried that, have gone to the ballot?
Chair Messerly and Senator Dukes, Yamhill, of course, has had one for 20 years. Marion got theirs 2 years ago. Polk got theirs this last year. Two others decided to try and came up short. That was Clackamas and Wasco. Two others, East Lane and Washington, came up to the day before making the application and submitting the papers to the county and decided not to do it because we were informed by the elections officer that it would cost us $55,000 to put it on the ballot. We went back and stared ourselves in the face and said, among the seven of us, are we prepared to come up with $55,000 out of our pocket? And our answer was no. There is a great deal of interest among some counties in doing so, some districts in doing so. I personally think that's a direction that needs to be explored for those districts who wish to, and because it is a local, it's a local option. It's a local vote that decides that. And I think that's definitely an avenue that needs to be explored by districts.
I agree with you. It seems that the funding for Seldom Water has gone up and down and up and down over the years, and that's about the only way to get any continuity.
Senator Dukes, if you walk into a district that has that base, and they can talk about planning long term, they can talk about, you know, staff that they can actually start to develop some skills and go through certification training and develop capacities and so forth, it's a whole different atmosphere when you go to their board meetings than you go to somebody saying, well, how much longer is our staff person funded this time? Makes a difference.
Any other questions? I just want to say I used to serve on the State Soil and Water Commission, and I'm very pleased to hear that you're a strong body and may be able to do some good things now. That's
fundamentally the partnership of the OECD board, the commission, and the department is better than it's ever been.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to that other conversation.
Okay, you bet. Next, I'd like to call on Matt Blevins and Peter Bloom.
Chair Messerly, if I can, Peter needs to leave soon, so if you could go first.
Okay, and we're running just a little bit late, so
I'll move right along.
Appreciate that.
Thank you, Chair Messerly, members of the committee. I'd like today to make just a few comments and join Carla Chambers in calling for full implementation of the pesticide reporting system. I've just finished a 35-year career as an extension agricultural engineer and an extension administrator. I retired at the end of December last year as associate director of the OSU Extension Service. During the past 2 years, I've also served as a member of the Oregon Environmental Council Board of Directors, and I serve on the OEC Agricultural Advisory Committee. And I'm committed to two very important ideas. One is the mission of OEC, the mission of bringing Oregonians together for a healthy environment. The other idea that I'm very committed to is that Oregon's farmers and ranchers have to be prosperous in order to be good stewards of our environment. Today, as I sit here, I'm also mindful of a good friend of mine who is an Australian extension worker who says that farmers are rightly suspicious of advice from anybody who doesn't have to wear the result. And I don't have to wear the result, but still, I am convinced that full implementation of our pesticide use reporting system will benefit all of Oregon's citizens, including farmers and ranchers. And that's why I urge that the program be fully funded in both the short and the long term. I want to mention just a few of the provisions of the law. One of the provisions of the law that I think is controversial is reporting by township, range, and section. And I think that provision is critical for making the system useful for research that's necessary for the continual improvement of our pest management systems in the state. Reporting by specific location is necessary to develop and modify our best management practices, to identify the pesticides that need to be phased in or phased out of use based upon the correlation between location of application and impacts that may be detrimental, be they health or environmental impacts. And so the continual improvement of how we use pesticides and how pests are managed in the state are dependent upon location-specific reporting. And I think we would sacrifice much of the benefit of the law if reporting is done by zip code or watershed. I'm also aware of concerns about confidentiality and security of the data with location-specific reporting. I know that the Department of Agriculture has responsibility for ensuring the confidentiality and security of that data, but I would like to offer another thought, which for me is really a pivotal point. Location-specific reporting is focused on the fate and the impacts, both intended and unintended, of the pesticide used. My assumption is that when pesticide use is reported, it'll be reported in accordance with label restrictions and in approved applications. And if that's the case, then the focus is on the pesticide and its impacts. It's not on the pesticide user. Having comprehensive data on pesticide use will also allow for health and environmental risk assessments to be based on actual use rather than on the assumption of maximum approved use. If you don't know what's being used and you're doing risk assessments, you have to assume that the maximum approved is the level being used. And farmers have long maintained that their use of pesticides is well below those maximums approved. I think the system will prove their claim, and I think it'll be very important and immediately useful in risk assessments. Location-specific data is also helpful, I think, in delaying the selection of resistance from within pest populations. Continued exposure to the same pesticide takes that infinitesimal, very small fragment of the population that has a biological resistance to that pesticide, and it breeds it up over time until it becomes a large segment of the population and the control practice fails. Knowing the population exposure to a pesticide allows for management strategies that interrupt that process of selection for resistance. And again, location-specific pesticide use reporting is a key ingredient of that. There are a couple of other things that I have some concerns about. I think retail sales is a concern. The reporting of retail sales to homeowners is an important missing piece, I think, in the law. Reporting of retail sales was made optional. The Department of Agriculture has elected not to require reporting of retail sales. Retail sales reporting would give the relative magnitude of homeowner versus commercial use of pesticides. I think that data is important, and I think that many farmers would agree that it's an important piece of data. And, of course, retail sales to homeowners occurs in all areas of the state. There's another point of implementation that concerns me. The rulemaking process allows commercial applicators in urban areas to report by zip code. With the availability of inexpensive GPS technology, it seems to me that location-specific reporting could be easily accomplished for commercial applications in urban areas. And location-specific data, I think, is just as important in urban areas as it is in rural areas of the state. So with that, I do urge the committee to ensure Oregon's pesticide use reporting system is fully funded, and I thank you for the opportunity to offer my thoughts.
Matt, why don't we go to you next, and then we'll open it for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Messerly, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Matt Blevins. I'm Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. I'm actually here representing not only OEC, but the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, and our partners in the Oregon Pesticide Education Network, together representing over 28,000 Oregonians. In these times of financial difficulties, we must spend the state's resources wisely. That's why OEC and our colleagues in the Open Coalition urge you to provide funding to complete development of Oregon's landmark pesticide use reporting system. ODA has already invested about $1 million into the pesticide use reporting system, and to waste that investment of public resources by not allowing the department to complete the system is simply not responsible. As most of you know, the law was passed by the 1999 legislature, and ODA is required to collect basic information about pesticide use in Oregon. Anyone who uses a pesticide for a commercial or government-related purpose in Oregon has to report his or her pesticide use to ODA. This law went into effect on January 1, 2002, and applies not just to Oregon farmers, but also to urban pest control companies, schools, golf courses, cities, road crews, and other commercial users. Household pesticide use is also being tracked via a survey being conducted by ODA. Pesticide use data will provide researchers, public officials, and the public with critical information on pesticide use across the state to help protect public health, salmon, and water quality. For example, a recent Center for Disease Control and Prevention CDC study tested thousands of people for 116 chemicals, 34 of them pesticides. The CDC found 19 of 34 pesticides in the blood or urine of test subjects. In Oregon, a fully functioning pesticide use reporting system will give us valuable information about how people may be exposed to these pesticides and ultimately allow us to develop programs to reduce those exposures. The 2001 legislature allocated $2.7 million to develop and implement the pesticide use reporting system. Instead of providing these funds directly, the legislature gave the emergency board control over approximately $1.4 million of these funds. ODA reduced the program's total biannual costs, including system development, to well below $2 million. Still, the department has been unable to complete the permanent system because the legislature has withheld the last installment of the funds needed. To stay in compliance with the law, the department set up an incomplete temporary system that allows pesticide users to file their reports. The temporary system falls far short of meeting the state law's mandates, as it cannot release data, nor is it designed to accommodate the large volume of reports the agency is getting. This is making it increasingly difficult for people to file the reports and problems that would be easily remedied with a small amount of money. The law requires ODA to publish an annual report summarizing the pesticide use data. That first report is legally due by July 1, 2003. At this point, it will be virtually impossible for ODA to complete their analysis of the data by that date. This will be a violation of the statutory requirement to provide pesticide use information to the public by 2003 of July. Again, the legislature can help remedy this situation by providing funds for the department. We need only to look to the South to see how valuable a pesticide use reporting system can be. The state of California has had a full pesticide use reporting system in place since 1990. There, growers and others report the exact location of their pesticide use with no confidentiality protections. Despite all the fears that have been expressed here, California's experience tells us that pesticide use data has not been used to harass or sue growers. In fact, we're aware of no such cases in the 13 years that the system has been in place, and it has been extremely helpful in understanding trends in pesticide use and for public health and water quality research. For example, the California Prune Board, which represents 1,400 growers and 21 packers of California prunes, conducted a study to assess the use of certain pesticides as a part of a program to reduce surface and groundwater contamination, among other things. The Prune Board interviewed 10 growers to assess use and then relied on the state's pesticide use reports to see if the interview results were a good representation of pesticide use among prune growers across the state. The pesticide use reports confirmed that few acres were being treated with the more problematic pesticides. This is just one example of how pesticide use information can be valuable. OPIN would also like to indicate our support for keeping the Oregon Pesticide Analytical Response Center, or PARC, funded. Over the last 24 years, Oregon has been at the forefront of studying and responding to possible pesticide poisoning incidents. PARC, operating on a budget of only $250,000 a year, has successfully united 8 state agencies to serve the unique function of responding to the public concerns regarding pesticides. PARC has been strategic in identifying trends in pesticide exposures, thereby curbing unsafe practices. In closing, I would like to reiterate the need for this fiscally responsible, for being fiscally responsible, which means not letting our investment of close to $1 million in the pesticide use reporting program be wasted. We recognize the limitations on general fund dollars, and as a result, our coalition is proposing legislation that would expand the existing pesticide dealer fee as a way to provide long-term, stable, and sufficient funding for Oregon's pesticide use reporting system. We look forward to working with the committee to ensure that the pesticide use reporting program is fully funded and functioning as it was originally envisioned. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, comments from the committee? I just want to make a very brief comment that we're caught in the in this body of the Ways and Means of trying to balance the needs of the public and the elderly and disabled with the general fund needs, as opposed to newer type programs like this. We're going to have to make some very difficult decisions. The discussion of the investment we've already got in this program, I can tell you, is discussed often, and so we're very concerned about that. But the bottom line is, are we talking about kids, public safety, and public health, and we're having to make some very difficult decisions. So appreciate your comments. I think they're good points. And not only this committee, but the full Ways and Means Committee is going to be looking very hard at what we've got and what we can salvage in our program. If there's no other questions, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Lars Maloney and Terry Witt.
My name is Lars Maloney. I'm the international manager for the Pacific Seafood Group, as well as an Oregon Trawl Commissioner. Pacific Seafood, as you may well know, was established in 1941. We're an Oregon-based company, and we're very proud to be an Oregon company. We have made quite a bit of investment in the state of Oregon over these many years, and we're dedicated to continuing our support to keep our Oregon's economy strong and vibrant, as well as keeping our fisheries sustainable and our coastal communities healthy. The global market truly has become a global market for seafood, as we all can understand and are not surprised by. The competition is stiff, and the change in those markets is always constant. Oregon's visibility is important and integral in the support of the goals of keeping our coastal communities healthy and keeping our fisheries sustainable. Department of Agriculture's efforts internationally in representing Oregon is as important now as it ever has been. Their targeted efforts on the highest levels have proven instrumental in raising the awareness of the real and high quality attributes of products that are produced in Oregon. The Department of Agriculture dig deep into their efforts to identify and understand market opportunities internationally. The Marketing Department staff of Department of Oregon Oregon Department of Agriculture is professional. They research markets, international markets. They efficiently coordinate their efforts with the State of Oregon offices internationally as well as ATO offices. They have very high credibility with officials and market people in different parts of the market internationally. Their efforts have clearly helped open doors to opportunities for all of us in the Oregon seafood industry, and that it would have taken us a long time to uncover. It is our opinion that the money invested in the support of the ODA marketing department is money that pays many broad dividends for the state of Oregon and coastal communities and fisheries in Oregon, and we're very deeply thankful for their efforts over the many years.
Thank you. Questions of the committee? Thank you very much, sir. Terry?
Chair Messaleed, members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt. I'm executive director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I think you're probably all well aware that our mission is to protect the safe and responsible use of pesticides, fertilizers, and biotechnology. As such, the department really is the chief and almost sole regulatory agency that we work with. We also work with the Department of Forestry and, to a certain extent, DEQ, but the Department of Ag regulates pesticides, basically food safety and fertilizers, so we work with them extensively. I think to start with, I'd like to at least thank some of the folks that have worked very patiently with us in the past, Lisa Hansen, Chuck Craig, Janet Fultz, on a number of programs, including the pesticide use reporting, Senate Bill 1010, fertilizer standards, and other programs. And I would be remiss if I did not extend gratitude to the former director, Phil Ward. Phil, I think, did a yeoman's job in his position, and we'll miss him, but we look forward to working with Katie Koba as well. I would like to just basically make a few general comments, and then I'll make some very specific comments with regard to certain programs that the department has the responsibility to deal with. The 0305 recommended budget by the governor for the department of $84.5 million is a pretty good investment when you stop and look at what that translates into with regard to economics for the state of Oregon. 97,000 jobs and $9 billion worth of economic activity. It's about a hundredfold increase for an investment, and that's not too bad in today's market. And I think when you look at the amount of general fund dollars that is devoted to the Department of Agriculture, it's minuscule. When you look at all the natural resource agencies as a whole, it's less than 2% of the total budget. And the general fund portion of the department's budget has been significantly reduced even over the last several biennia, being cut from 36% general fund funded in the 99-01 budget to the proposed budget before you today of 25%, or a reduction of 11% general fund funding. So the more and more of the revenue source is being shifted to other funds, and we all know what that means. That normally means fees, licenses, and other types of revenue sources that come from the regulated community. A lot of that is very, very important, because the number one, I think, important job of the department is to maintain the safety and the quality of Oregon's agricultural products. That's the hallmark of our products that leave the state of Oregon, which about 80% of our farm gate produce does, and much of that is exported overseas. And as was previously testified by other persons before you today, quality, particularly in foreign markets, is of number one importance. We need to maintain those programs like the food safety program, the animal health, nursery, and Christmas tree export service center, and the ag development program. Those are all very, very essential programs that are run by the department that have a very positive impact on the bottom line, so to speak, for the state of Oregon. There are certain general assistance programs that I think are also essential to the viability of agriculture in Oregon that perhaps don't directly appear to impact the bottom line, and that is programs like their number 10 priority, which is weed control. That's a very, very significant program in the state of Oregon. The plant pest and disease control program, which was their number 3 priority, is of high importance
and unfortunately one that was way down the list that had been brought up by Richard Kosasan, which is the predator control, was number 24 on their priority list, but that does play a very, very significant role, and we'd like to see that elevated in terms of priority and funding. Two key regulatory programs that OFS has been involved in over the last, well, since I've been here in Oregon, which is about 20 years now, is the fertilizer program, which we just overhauled last biennium. That program is 100% funded by other fees. It's about a $1.2 million program, all of which is paid for by the fertilizer community. The base pesticide program, which basically implements the federal laws known as FIFRA in the state of Oregon, gets zero general fund dollars. That is is $3.6 million on the back of the pesticide industry and about a little less than $1 million in federal funds. So of the two major programs that impact the chemical use arena in the state of Oregon, there are zero general fund dollars being expended. It's all on the back, primarily on the back of the user community. There are two other programs that I'd just like to mention that are low on the priority list that I think deserve some comment. And hold your seats. I agree with Oregon Environmental Council on one of them, and that is that we do need to find funding to return PARC to the Department of Ag's list of viable programs. They lost $250,000 during, I think it was the fifth special session, which cut that program out. It is a very, very important program, particularly from the standpoint of the user community, because it provides a scientific, unbiased forum by which people who believe they have been affected by pesticides, whether it be through human impact or through impact to animals or the environment, have a forum by which they can get an evaluation done by scientifically and disinterested third parties. And that's been a very, very valuable tool, I think, for all involved. And the industry highly supports finding somewhere the $250,000 to reinstitute that program. With regard to the other program, it's been mentioned several times, and that's the pesticide use reporting program. And OFS was integrally involved in writing that law that was adopted and working on the rules. I think what we have to do is look at this program in two phases. And I don't envy the task that you have in trying to make tough priority decisions with limited dollars. But I think we can divide the program into two phases. The first phase is the actual development of the program itself. And as was stated, I think correctly by Matt, the department has spent roughly around $1 million since the inception of the program, and they are about $250,000 short of having the permanent program completed. That's the development phase of it. The second part of the situation then is, once we develop it, can we operate it? And I think those two can be looked at separately from a standpoint of making economic decisions. But obviously you can't do the second if you don't do the first. So I would highly recommend that you try to find some dollars available to finish the program. I do differ in the testimony that was given from the standpoint of strapping the industry with additional financial burden by creating another fee on retail pesticide dealers. The law was written specifically with a 50-50 split between general fund and the user community, and that was done for a reason, and that is that the majority of the benefit that is to be derived from this program is general fund, is to the general benefit of the public, and therefore they do need to pay some of the funds to make this program work. If we don't do that, then this is very likely to be a runaway program that just gets dumped on the backs of the user community, and the fees then go up exponentially. So I would support working with you in any way we can to find some sort of resolution to this problem, and leave you with one, I think, key thought, and that is that there is a problem that, regardless of what we do with funding and what we do with finishing the program or operating the program, there is a situation that must be resolved, and that is that there is a legal mandate in the statute for pesticide users to report And there is a mandate for the department to file a report July of this year. With the current situation the way it is, neither of those things can happen. And so we have this kind of this conundrum that what do? You have a statute that says X. You have reality that says Y. And how do we resolve those two? Hopefully not via a lawsuit, but that's most likely what would happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Question?
Next, I'd like to call Mr. Tom Fuller. And Tom, I apologize. Your name was crossed off my list. So.
My error.
Okay. And we have about a little over 15 minutes for three, counting yourself. So.
I'll be quick. For the record, my name is Tom Fuller. I work for a project management development consulting firm in Portland, Shields Douglas Johnson, and I'm here to testify in behalf and support of the Agricultural Development and Marketing Division. I had presented some earlier written testimony. I don't know if you have copies of that before you. I'm here to talk about why I think this division should continue to be funded. We have and are working with the division on projects to develop new value-added agricultural products for sale domestically and internationally. We are currently working with the division to build a value-added manufacturing plant to process market beef and dairy cows in the Madras, Oregon area. And we are currently working with the division on projects that have the potential to create new family wage jobs in rural Oregon. One might ask, why fund the division with general fund dollars? Are you looking for my testimony, Mr. Chairman?
Well, I was just checking to make sure.
I had given it to the committee assistant earlier. I'm sorry. One might ask, why do we fund this with general fund dollars? And I feel the following are reasons why it's appropriate and necessary to fund the division. First, the work done by the division benefits all of Oregon agriculture, in particular through its efforts to work with other public and private partners to develop and pursue value-added opportunities for Oregon agricultural products. For example, former Senator Tom Hartung and Dalton Hobbs helped to develop a market for frozen Oregon Dungeness crab through markets in Taiwan. The department also works with private and public partners to develop new markets for Oregon agricultural products. As an example, Senator Hartung and I at the Seafood Consumer Center in Astoria introduced an oyster grower to the division for help in developing overseas markets for oysters. I am pleased to state that as a result of that introduction, they are now selling oysters in Asia. Senator Dukes, I was just referring to the division's help through the Seafood Consumer Center in Astoria in creating a market for oysters. Also, the division is often out front working with other state agencies such as the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department and Oregon State University to create new opportunities for Oregon agricultural products. They help create new ideas and working groups that directly interface with end users. Let me give you a specific example. Yesterday, I was involved in a meeting at the Food Innovation Center, which, as you know, is co-located with the division in Portland, to set up a program called an Entrepreneur in Residence program at the Food Innovation Center to help people with great ideas for food products get them to markets. Jerry Gardner has been working closely to help push this idea along. These activities are for the general benefit of Oregon agriculture and should be paid for with general fund dollars. The division is on the cutting edge of bringing new opportunity and jobs to Oregon. This is what the general fund should do and is what we as taxpayers expect it to do. It is an investment of very limited state funds to leverage additional private investment to create new tax revenues, both real property and income taxes, and to create family wage jobs, often in our rural communities. The division helps agriculture take underutilized products with unrealized market opportunities and develop real revenue that translates into new taxes paid to the state of Oregon and jobs for our residents. In my opinion, many of the division's employees function as entrepreneurs who are trying to develop new products and market them as if it was for their own business. In conclusion, I believe the division is one of Oregon's best opportunities to create new value-added products and family wage jobs in Oregon, in particular in rural Oregon. The division has earned your full support and confidence.
I thank you for this opportunity to testify and would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. Any questions in the committee? Appreciate your testimony, and it will be part of the record.
Thank you.
Written record, too. Next, I'd like to call Christina McNett and Mark Simmons. Save the best to last.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. My written testimony is a little bit more detailed, but I just wanted to bring to you a story from the perspective of a user of the Oregon Department of Ag, and you might not quite get the automatic connection with Small Woodlands, but last fall I got a phone call from a nursery operator in Klamath County, and Klamath Falls to be specific. And at that time, information had just been released that a fungus known as Phytophthora ramorum was found to be in Douglas fir, which is devastating for our industry. And this nursery operator needed to know how he could continue to get his products across the United States and through any potential quarantines. At that time, sudden oak death had been found in other materials, but not in something like Douglas fir. What was and frankly is still scary is that it's unclear how sudden oak death is spread. Infected plants and products move interstate are clearly potential pathways for the introduction of the disease. Presently, no known treatment exists for the infected plants that kills the fungus but allows the plant host species to survive. And according to a UC Davis website, there is no feasible treatment for trees in a woodland setting. So it's rather severe. Since its initial discovery in Marin County, California in 1995, 11 additional counties have been listed in California for a total of 12. So here's the good story about Oregon Department of Ag. California is not attempting to eradicate sudden oak death from the state and has just chosen to quarantine any county where it's been confirmed to exist, regardless of the distribution within that county. Unlike California, Oregon is attempting to eradicate Phytophthora ramorum from the infected areas. Oregon's also able to place quarantines on a sub-county level. Currently, Oregon has a 9-square-mile quarantine area in Coos County near Brookings. No nursery or Christmas tree plantations are located within the Curry County quarantine area, but there are many woodlots. On the ground and aerial surveys in the summer of 2001 revealed 39.6 areas of infection within the Curry County quarantine area. The Oregon Department of Agriculture, USDA, the Oregon Department of Forestry, BLM, and private landowners all responded quickly to slash the infected areas and prepare them for burning. A cut, pile, and burn treatment was applied in two areas in the early fall of 2001, and due to weather, the remaining areas were burned in the late fall and early winter of 2001, but all had been burned by early spring in 2002. Similar surveys during the summer of 2002, last summer, revealed approximately 12 areas of mostly secondary infections, 12 acres, excuse me. Of the 12 acres, 4 to 5 were considered new sites. So there you go, from 39.6 acres to 12, four to five of them new sites. I think that's just a tremendous story to tell about the Oregon Department of Agriculture, especially contrasted with California, and how they immediately took a hold of this problem and tried to prevent it from growing and are still working with landowners actively on this issue. And that's all I'd like to say.
Christina, can we document whether that infects that area in Curry County came from California?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that. Perhaps someone from Oregon Department of Agriculture would know, but as far as I know right now, they're not even sure how this fungus spreads, so I'm not sure they can track where it came from.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Mark, you're on the other side of the table this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Before he begins his testimony, have you testified before this committee before?
No, I have not.
Well, let's all get
Morgan.
A blank.
I'm going to stay a little longer.
In honor
about this momentous occasion, I think we should just take a moment to recognize that welcome to that side of the table. This is kind of a switch for all of us.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here. I know you guys will make good decisions with the challenges before you. I know they are very tough decisions, but very capable people to make those decisions, and I'm happy to be sitting here today and not over there. So,
and we'll make better decisions following your testimony.
Absolutely. That's what this is all about, right? No, actually, I am Mark Simmons. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Nurserymen. And I would concur with the positive statements about the department and the cooperative, close working relationship between the Department of Agriculture and the agriculture community in the state of Oregon. And we're excited about working with Katie Koba, the new director, and just continuing that relationship that we've had in the past. And do believe, with a lot of the governor's statements about seeing agriculture begin leading the way out of this recession, that it can happen. And the nurserymen, as the largest segment of agriculture in the state of Oregon, with nearly $700 million a year in wholesale sales off the farm, about $300 million of that going into payroll each year, want to be part of that in helping agriculture lead Oregon out of this current recession. 80% of our products are shipped out of state, and we have a reputation for quality. Oregon is the nursery state. Our largest domestic markets are on the East Coast, and our competitors for that East Coast market are nurseries in the Ohio Valley and nurseries on the East Coast and some in the mid-Atlantic states. And we have a competitive disadvantage in freight costs and the amount of minimum wage we pay to our workers. But because of our reputation for quality, we are able to compete and hold our share of that market. It's the close working relationship and regulatory oversight and support of the Department of Agriculture that allows us to ensure that consistent quality. Christina stole my story about sudden oak death, Phytophthora rubrumorum. It's a remarkable story about how the department acted very quickly to a potential disaster for this industry. It could have, if it spreads into the Willamette Valley and the nurseries here in the Willamette Valley, it will be absolutely devastating. And we will see this large income source to the state of Oregon devastated. It will almost evaporate. I know that money is tight, but the marketing efforts that the department carries on are vital. For an example, we are making significant inroads with the department's support into Japan, opening that as a new market for Oregon products. Japan currently purchases about $400 million a year of nursery products from the Netherlands. And as a Pacific Rim state, that's a natural market for us. And with the agency's support, we're up to several hundred thousand dollars a year now of exports to Japan. And as you all know, once you get your foot in the door, those markets can expand exponentially. It's been a big job getting to here, and we never would have got there without the support of the department. So that's just one little piece of the marketing area where they do things that farmers cannot do individually and producers cannot achieve individually, both for the diplomatic reasons and others. It will allow us to make an even greater positive impact on the state of Oregon and the economy here. The second bill up today is the fee bill, Senate Bill 5502. We are in support of the fee increases for both nursery licenses and phytosanitary certificates and such as it will be amended. I understand that there are some changes to the bill. I understand they're being drafted, and we would support it.
Very much, Mark. Comments?
Now let me off easy.
We're weak. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your
thank
coming.
Thank you.
We did pull the sign-up sheet. Has there been anyone else come in that would like to testify? Okay, with that, thank you all for your participation, and I guess mostly the department left here, but thank you for the last 5 days.
And I think we've all learned a lot and got a good understanding. So with that, we'll close the public hearing and close. Should remind the committee, no committee meetings next week, and we'll be working. Not that we have a vacation, but we're not going to hold these hearings. So that will close the committee.